This time on your weekly Constitutional, something called net neutrality.
It's really a concept of regulation that would allow all material to go over the internet at the same speed without discrimination.
That was Roy Gutterman of Syracuse University, who's concerned about the Trump administration's recent reversal of an Obama administration rule requiring net neutrality. But Daniel Lyons of Boston College doesn't think that abandonment of net neutrality is a big deal.
We have more than one source to get our information, and even with regard to how that information is delivered to us, if all we're concerned about is dissemination of information, there's a lot of options available to consumers.
This week, it's all about net neutrality.
Welcome to your weekly Constitutional, underwritten by the Robert H. Smith Center for the Constitution at James Madison's historic home, Montpelier. Your host is Professor Stuart Harris, who teaches constitutional law at the Duncan School of Law of Lincoln Memorial University.
Net neutrality is a term that's been much in the news lately. Perhaps you've heard it. Perhaps you've wondered precisely what it means. We'll hear from two experts today. One of them is a fellow by the name of Daniel Lyons, who's from Boston College and who doesn't think that net neutrality is such a big deal, nor is he particularly worried that the Trump administration has recently reversed a rule of the Obama administration, fancy that, that had supposedly protected net neutrality. Then we'll hear from Roy Gutterman. He's very concerned about the loss of net neutrality. Roy is from Syracuse University, specifically the S.I. Newhouse School of Public Communications. Indeed, he's the director of something called the Tully Center for Free Speech.
I'm Roy Gutterman. I teach communications law and run the Tully Center for Free Speech at the Newhouse School of Syracuse University.
Well, it sounds to me like then you know a little bit about free speech. What do you think about this net neutrality issue that we've been hearing about recently?
Well, the net neutrality issue has been a hot button issue for people who follow it for 10 to 15 years since the government really got involved in regulating how we access electronic information. So, you know, we've seen a shift with the government to change the standards and change the policies and change how this wonderful medium that we all rely on is now regulated.
Let's start at the beginning. You said about 10 or 15 years ago, how did the government, the government played a part, obviously, in the creation of the internet originally, but when did it actually start regulating what was on the internet?
The beginning of the regulation of the internet came about the Telecommunications Act of 1996. And again, that's when the internet really became more what I would say commercial. You know, regular people, regular citizens were dialing up on modems, or going to universities or government offices and accessing the internet. And once regular people started using it, the government realized that there needed to be some regulation on this. So that's sort of the infant stages of the regulation. It came through with the Telecommunications Act of 1996. And it's become a hot potato ever since.
Yeah, it's kind of funny you should mention that as 96, because that might have been the very year that in my law practice down in Florida, my wife and I practiced together, and we decided that we finally had to go and get this thing called the internet installed on our computers. So we had to get this modem and figure out all that stuff, and didn't know the difference between a website and an email address for a while. But my clients were insisting upon communicating that way, and it did revolutionize our practice. I recall that very shortly thereafter, I was able to go on a trip out of state, even though we had an impending deadline, because we were able to trade copies of a draft motion back and forth. And so we started using it for business pretty quickly then. Now, younger people just snicker when I mention these things. Of course, the internet's been a part of their lives ever since they can remember. But I'm old enough, perhaps you are too, to remember pre-internet days. And that's the way these things usually happen. A new technology comes along, and for a while, it's just out there. And then eventually the government says, maybe there's some regulation that needs to be done. So I guess that was the Telecommunications Act of 96.
Yeah, and even the 96 law was, the internet was still pretty basic for regular users. Unless you happen to be an engineer or somebody involved in the government, it was really brand new for a lot of us. I got my first laptop and my first laptop computer in 1995, and it had a modem, and I thought it was the coolest thing that I could.
And it weighed 65 pounds.
It was kind of heavy.
Yeah, my first one too. Same thing.
It was so neat because it could go. I could plug my computer into a telephone jack. I could press a couple of buttons and get a dial tone, and my computer became essentially a telephone.
Right, a communications device. It was revolutionary. What, in broad terms, what did the Telecommunications Act of 1996 do?
It created what we would consider categories of services. And the categorization of the services, fast forward to contemporary times, really got into how the government may or may not regulate these internet service companies. And it's dense legislation. It's dense. It's not fun to read. It's legalese in many ways. But when we get into the nuts and bolts of what we're dealing with today, it goes back to the categories of companies and services that we're now dealing with today.
So depending upon which category a particular company is or type of company is put into, then the government's either going to regulate it more or less or in different ways.
Correct. There's Title I classification, which is the broadband service designation, would require less, that would justify less government regulation. And then there's the Title II classification, which classifies services as akin to utilities, public utilities, which would then allow the government to have more of a regulatory hand. And again, these are designations that lawyers, FCC officials, and people in those areas really pay a lot of attention to. But, regular people don't care if their internet is a Title I or a Title II service. They just want access to the internet. Obviously, they probably don't want to pay a lot of money for it either.
Okay, well, enter the concept then of net neutrality. And according to your recent article, which I read online, this was a term that was coined back in 2003, was it?
Yeah, you can credit Professor Tim Wu at Columbia for giving us this nice term that we all use.
Okay, and what exactly does net neutrality mean?
Yeah, that question depends on who you're talking to in some ways. But the general concept is that the internet should be free of certain types of controls, that there's no content discrimination, that there's no throttling or other kinds of barriers that would discriminate against certain types of content or information, and then on the converse of that, benefit others. So it's really kind of a concept of regulation that would allow all material to go over the internet at the same speed without discrimination.
Okay, so no matter whom I get my service through, and no matter what subscription services I might pay for, a subscription to a newspaper or some other website, all of that content should be traveling at more or less the same speed and be available on more or less the same basis. Okay, so that seems kind of like what the internet's always stood for. I mean, again, going back to the 90s, the days of the Wild Wild West, that was always the lure. It's all these people that said this is a free and open, wide open market, everybody shares. I recall even people objecting to the commercialization of the internet. As quaint as that sounds now, it was supposed to be just this wonderful forum where everybody could say anything anyone wanted to. And there's an allure to that. But of course, much of the regulation that you allude to was a response to that. And frequently, of course, there were attempts to keep certain sorts of content away from children. That doesn't seem to have worked very well. So there are problems with this free and open concept, but that was basically where it all started. And so apparently there are people who want to change that.
Well, when cable companies started diversifying, also in the 90s, they realized that there could be a profit motive here. Cable companies, remember when we all started getting wired for cable back in the 70s and 80s, you know, cable companies were smaller, regional, local, and they had to negotiate with municipalities to get easements or permission to lay the wires so that people could buy cable. Well, cable companies started diversifying, and they realized that you know, they were merging with telecommunications companies, and then they realized that people would be using, you know, would need the internet as well. So, I mean, there's a reason why nowadays you can order your cable television, your internet access, and even a landline telephone through the same entity. And once these companies started consolidating and getting bigger and getting more diversified, then we realized that, you know, there is potential here for bigger problems for consumers and bigger more potential for these companies to have more control or control content that could be delivered. Because now these companies aren't just giving you access to media, they're also, some of these companies are also providing media, or they have their own media entities. So
Roy, you used the C word there, cable. And I think that's sort of the nemesis of a lot of people, and it has all sorts of negative connotations, and among them is poor service and rigid control of content, which then becomes more and more expensive with time. So it sounds like the cable companies and similar entities have gotten into the internet provision service, and they no longer simply want to be conduits. They want to be conduits that have various valves and switches that can control exactly what goes into those pipes. And of course, ultimately, for a profit motive. Now, that's understandable. If I own a cable company or if I own an internet service provider, I want to maximize my profit. So, you know, that's understandable. On the other hand, is that something that's good for the public? You described earlier that there were these two categories, and one of them was more like a utility. So what I'm guessing then is that net neutrality is treating the internet more like a utility, with lots of regulations that, to some extent, guarantee net neutrality. But taking those regulations away is allowing cable companies to come in and essentially control things themselves.
Well, that's pretty much what the FCC did in December.
Yeah.
By changing the category, by changing the title through which we categorize these companies, they're no longer considered a public utility, and now they're considered, they're reclassified as broadband or service companies. So. So the control, the element of control, the ability for the government to lay down rules about neutrality have shifted. And, you know, many people worry that this is going to open the doors to potential for content discrimination. But they're not saying, again, the cable companies aren't saying they're going to discriminate against content. But what they're saying is, if you pay a premium, your content will be delivered faster. And there's more of a nefarious concern here, or concern for less benign motivations.
Right.
Perhaps a cable company that is also a content provider wants their content to go faster. So that their content will go faster, possibly at the expense of a competitor or a company that may not negotiate to get into the fast lane. Again, the concerns are out there, and nobody has come forward and said that they're going to discriminate. But let's face it, nobody is going to admit openly that they're going to discriminate anyway. So yeah. We'll find out the hard way.
Yeah, we will find out, and perhaps we'll find out somewhat similarly to the brouhaha over the Apple, the old iPhones. Consumers for a long time complained that they thought their old iPhones were being deliberately slowed down, and then it turns out they were.
Yep.
And Apple is saying that they had a reason for that, and it had to do with battery preservation. But I'm sure there are a lot of people out there that wonder if it's simply Apple's attempt to get them to buy newer iPhones, or for whatever other reason that would benefit Apple.
It's Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and we're talking to Roy Gutterman, who's the director of the Tully Center for Free Speech at Syracuse University. Roy is very concerned about the FCC's recent abandonment of something called net neutrality. After the break, we'll finish our discussion with Roy, and then we'll hear from Daniel Lyons of Boston College, who has a different opinion. Stick around.
The internet. Repository of all human knowledge and videos of goats singing Taylor Swift songs.
You've undoubtedly heard about something called net neutrality.
Net neutrality
is once again under attack.
I think net neutrality is the dumbest stuff ever.
Earlier this afternoon, the FCC voted to repeal net neutrality.
Yeah. Today, a terrible day for the internet, a terrible day for America. Ajit Pai, the FCC Commission Chairman, cast a deciding vote to kill net neutrality on the internet.
It's a Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and now it's time to continue our discussion with Roy Gutterman of Syracuse University, who's very concerned about the FCC's recent decision to abandon something called net neutrality.
I guess there are a couple of issues here. One of them is the concern over income equality, and are we stratifying the internet and making it better for rich people and worse for poor people? To some extent, that already exists, doesn't it? Because there are still people out there that are paying for dial-up, probably paying less, and getting much worse service than those of us who have access to and the ability to afford broadband.
And there's some people who can't afford it at all.
Exactly. And then there's issues of affordability. So in some sense, that's a familiar issue. It's an unfortunate circumstance. I don't know if it's entirely avoidable, but this might tend to exacerbate it, you've told me. But more to the issue of free speech, when you don't require cable companies or other internet service providers to be more or less neutral, now it starts getting a bit more troubling. Are they actually going to start discriminating on the basis of content that would have even more nefarious overtones, that would be perhaps discriminating against certain sorts of speech on a political basis?
I mean, that's been a concern for a lot of people ever since this issue reared its head. And again, it's one of those things we don't know. We don't know if some, you know, if some big faceless corporation is going to, if the CEO is going to wake up one day and say, well, you know what, I don't like this kind of speech, I don't like this message, I don't like this website, I don't like this person, let's slow it down or let's block it. I mean, we don't know.
And that's very troubling. I mean, I'm not going to pick on anybody in particular, but we all know that there are news organizations out there that are slanted in some fashion or another, and that might very well decide that they're not going to provide, or they're going to slow down content that doesn't agree with their corporate ethos or their political leanings. And, you know, as long as that's only something that comes out of their provision of services, I mean, if I want to go to Fox News, for example, I pretty much know that I'm going to get a certain perspective as opposed to MSNBC. But these people are not just content providers anymore. They're the actual people who are giving us the ability to access either of those sites.
Yeah, and we juxtapose that. We can juxtapose that to, you know, places in the world that we know block internet content because the government has the means to do that.
Right.
I'm not going to name any countries here, but we know who some of these countries are. We know, you know, certain dictatorships do that sort of thing. And the question is, do we want to set up a mechanism akin to a dictatorship?
Yep, even if it's in private hands. And that's an important distinction to make because, as I'm sure you know, the First Amendment only kicks in when the government is part of the process. If the government is restricting access to communication or information, then you have a fairly clear-cut First Amendment issue. Here, we're talking about private entities making private decisions to regulate content, probably on the basis of some profit motive, perhaps on the basis of a political bias. But these are private entities, and so one could argue that just like a newspaper decides what it's going to print, it's perfectly okay for cable company ABC to also decide what content it's going to provide.
Yeah, and that goes back to the Title I versus Title II categorization of these companies.
Yeah, that's the government nexus. In fact, if I were arguing this case, that's where I would say that you know, by allowing this, the government has effectively allowed censorship, even though the government's not censoring the content itself. I don't know if that would be enough of a nexus to government action to kick in the First Amendment, but I think that's the argument, isn't it?
That is the argument. I also agree. I don't know if that's enough of a connection. But again, it goes back to the public utility argument that, you know, even if this is in private hands, even if this great mechanism and network is in private hands, it's a limited access resource that would warrant some level of regulation on the issue of content, or some level of guarantee from the government that there will be neutrality here. And again, it goes back to the limited access, limited spectrum, almost like it's almost a spectrum argument like we used to see with broadcasting.
Yeah, actually, and the fact I was just going to mention that there are some rules, I think, that are still out there regulating at least to some degree, equal access to the airwaves, FCC regulations, when it comes to at least elections.
Well, yeah.
Are those still in place, or have those eroded as well?
Some of those have eroded. You know, the Fairness Doctrine has been dead for years. That required equal access to airtime. But there's still some other rules on providing access to buying ad space and ad time and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And again, the idea is the government doesn't take sides, but it makes sure that everybody has a chance, or to some extent tries to do that. Well, where do you stand on these issues, Roy? I mean, do you think this is a good decision by the regulators or not?
I do not agree with the FCC's policy shift on this. I don't believe in heavy regulation, but I think if you let businesses make their own rules, you're going to get things you don't want or things that we don't like. So, you know, I did agree with the classification of the internet as a public resource, and that there should be some rules establishing neutrality. But again, you know, these are private companies that do invest a lot of money in the infrastructure.
And isn't that their argument, that if you deregulate them and you allow them to maximize their profits, then they'll have more capital and perhaps more incentive to invest in more infrastructure that will then bring internet or better internet to more remote areas? Isn't that what they're arguing?
Well, that's their argument, that, you know, I'll believe it. I will believe the reinvestment in rural broadband when I see it.
Right.
You know, luckily I live in a city in the Northeast that's, you know, pretty well connected. If I lived in the middle of nowhere or in some region where we didn't have really good access or any access, I'd be eager to see how this deregulation will bring the internet to my home.
It's funny you should mention where you live. You're up in Syracuse. I'm in Knoxville, Tennessee. And although this is a fine city with fine internet service, the region, of course, is the TVA, the Tennessee Valley. And that was authorized, of course, back, I believe it was in the 30s. And it was part of the rural electrification program because electric companies were making some of the same arguments that cable companies and others make today, that they it's not profitable for them to run electric lines into remote areas. And therefore, they're not going to invest in the infrastructure. And so the government stepped in and to some extent required that sort of thing to happen, certainly provided incentives, carrots as well as sticks. But that was something that it really kind of needed the government to step in, or at least that's what the government did. And it resulted in lots of electricity flowing to lots of farms in remote places. So I guess private entities are always going to be arguing that they need freedom to maximize their profits. I guess I share your skepticism. I wonder whether in 5 or 10 years we're really going to see that much more access in these remote areas.
Yeah, I mean, we can say the same thing for the corporate tax cuts that we're going to see too. So,
I guess you just wait and see what happens. I guess you can always change the law back. Do you see any problem with changing the law back if once we've allowed this sort of free reign by the corporations?
Well, Congress has made some efforts since the December FCC action. That hasn't gone anywhere. Some states, including New York, have spoken out against the FCC policy shift. And again, laws are reflective of who's in power. So,
just assuming, for example, that Congress changed its mind or Congress did get motivated to do this, I guess if this is something. My point is, this is something that's fixable. If 5 years from now we see, abuses of this sort, if 5 years from now there is no improvement in service or major investment that follows on this, this is something that could be reversed, I would think, given the political will. I tend to agree with you. I don't think there's any political will to do so right now. But it's not an irretrievable problem.
No. It would require either an awakening on parts of several FCC commissioners or a shift in the government where there are new commissioners that get appointed, but they've got long terms.
Okay. Well, Roy Gutterman of Syracuse University, I very much appreciate your speaking with us today. This has been very enlightening, and I guess we'll all pay attention over the next few years.
Well, hopefully we can all get on the internet and we'll see what happens.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You're listening to Your Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and we've just heard from Roy Gutterman of Syracuse University, who's telling us about his concerns about the Federal Communications Commission's recent decision to abandon something called net neutrality. Other people have different takes on this, and one of them is Daniel Lyons. He's a law professor from Boston College, and he recently wrote an article in the National Review saying, hey, abandoning net neutrality, not such a big deal.
Hi, my name is Daniel Lyons. I'm a professor of law at Boston College, where I write and study the issues of telecommunications and internet law. I'm also a visiting fellow at the American Enterprise Institute.
What's the American Enterprise Institute for the Uninitiated?
It's a Washington, D.C.-based think tank that does research on various public policy initiatives. I'm involved in their technology and economics unit.
I see. And you've been publishing a lot in the National Review over the past few months. Excellent articles, by the way.
Thank you. That's very kind of you.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, very, very well written, very easy to understand. And they are about something called net neutrality, which seems to be right up your alley. What is this thing, net neutrality?
So net neutrality is one of those amorphous terms, right? It can mean different things to different people. I think at its base, most would agree that it basically means that internet service providers should treat all internet content more or less the same way, and it shouldn't prioritize some kind of traffic over others based upon either what type of content it is or the identity of the sender.
So equal access for all. We're going back to the roots of the internet where it was all Wild West and free.
That's right. And it's been in the news recently because in 2015, the FCC, the Federal Communications Commission, adopted a series of regulations that imposed net neutral behavior on internet service providers.
So before 2015, that wasn't mandated then?
That's right. Before 2015, internet service providers were essentially unregulated. They were what we called information providers under Title I of the Communications Act, which meant they were largely free of federal regulation.
And we're talking about ISPs or internet service providers. We're talking about those companies that provide these days, we hope, broadband access and back in the old days, the dial-up access, right?
That's right. The Comcast and Verizons and AT&Ts of the world that bring internet content not only to homes through landline connections, but also wireless internet providers.
Well, were there problems prior to 2015 which prompted the changing in their status to provide for this net neutrality?
So there were one or two issues, but not ones that suggested it was a significant concern. I think most net neutrality advocates would concede that the primary concern with net neutrality was prophylactic rules, not to correct ongoing behavior. There was a situation in 2005 involving a small internet provider called Madison River, which was an old phone company, I believe, in Virginia. They were launching broadband service, but they didn't want their customers to buy broadband and then cancel their telephone service because they needed to get the revenue from both. So they adopted a practice of blocking VoIP providers, companies like Vonage that provide voice service over the internet. And were taken to the FCC, and the FCC found that was problematic and fined them for it. There was another instance in which Comcast got caught in 2008 slowing down a program called BitTorrent, which was allowed peer-to-peer file sharing that was probably would have been a net neutrality violation if the rules had been in effect. But other than those two incidents, it's not clear that ISPs were engaged in non-net neutral behavior. Most of them practiced what they would consider net neutrality voluntarily. This was much more about making sure that they continued doing what the FCC thought they should do rather than punishing any past conduct.
Understood. Yeah, I was hearing about this back in the early 20-teens. There was a group called Public Knowledge, I believe, right near you in Boston, run by one of my old law school classmates. Her name is Gigi Sohn. Have you ever worked with them or come in contact with that group?
Yeah, Public Knowledge is actually, I think, one of the primary consumer advocates that is on the net neutrality side of the debate. Gigi has moved back and forth between Public Knowledge, and she was an advisor to FCC Chairman Tom Wheeler in 2015 when these rules got into effect.
Yeah, yeah. Small world. Okay, so there was some concern and some evidence that there were some problems with, as you say, blocking or perhaps throttling in the case of Comcast. And so the Obama administration or the FCC during the Obama administration adopted these rules and with some degree of fanfare or protecting the internet. I'm guessing, though, just based on what you're saying, that you don't think it was absolutely necessary for them to do that?
Yeah, so I guess what I would want to do is distinguish between what the rules were and the vehicle by which the rules were adopted, right?
Mm-hmm.
So the rules themselves required internet service providers to, they prevented them from blocking lawful internet content, prevented them from throttling content, meaning slowing down some types of internet traffic, and it prevented a practice called paid prioritization, which is the prioritizing of some traffic over others in exchange for a fee. And the way in which the rules were adopted ultimately was by reclassifying broadband providers not as information providers under the lightly regulated Title I regime of the Communications Act, but instead reclassifying them as telecommunications providers under Title II, which effectively subjected them to a light version of the regulations that we originally designed to control the old Bell telephone monopoly.
And as you point out in your articles, those regulations really don't mesh very well with the 21st century.
Yeah, so these are rules that were originally written in the 1930s. They were last updated in 1996. That was back in the days when only about half of us had dial-up. Those who did have dial-up, those who did have internet had dial-up, right? That weird like donkey static noise. Eeyawk.
Yes.
And so the real issue here, right, is that the statute doesn't really make clear what, if any, jurisdiction the FCC has over broadband access. And so in order to solve that problem, the FCC essentially said, you look a lot like a phone company, but we're going to refrain from applying the entire panoply of phone company rules to you. We're only going to apply some of them. It's sort of like a makeshift rule, but it's like pounding square pegs into round holes. There's no real good solution under the existing statute to give the FCC authority to do what it wanted to do.
So you think we should maybe have a statutory update?
I think ultimately that's where we're going, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's sort of ironic that the Federal Communications Commission has no clear statutory mandate to regulate the primary communications network of the 21st century. I think we're long overdue for Congress to adopt a series of rules that make very clear what, if any, authority the FCC has in this area.
Well, I remember they told me all the way back in law school all those decades ago that technology moves much more quickly than the law does. And I think that that is truer today than it's ever been before. You're listening to your weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris. And today we're speaking with Daniel Lyons of Boston College,
who doesn't think it's a big deal that the FCC recently abandoned something called net neutrality. After the break, we'll finish our discussion with Daniel Lyon. Stick around. It's your Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and this week our subject is something called net neutrality and the fact that the FCC recently abandoned it. Earlier, we heard from Roy Gutterman of Syracuse University, who's rather concerned about this. But now we're talking to Daniel Lyons. He's a law professor at Boston College, and he recently wrote an article in the National Review where he said, not such a big deal. Okay, so these rules, these 2015 rules imposing these three requirements for net neutrality were recently reversed, were recently abandoned by the new FCC, which has a majority of more Republican-leaning commissioners. And a lot of people are gnashing their teeth and rending their garments, and you think that's overblown, right?
Yeah, I do. I think essentially what the FCC did was bring us back to the legal framework that governed up until 2015. And so a lot of these sort of doom and gloom scenarios that I think some have put out there about the end of net neutrality are a bit overblown. I think there's a situation where the rhetoric is outpacing reality. I think it's absolutely right that broadband companies have some incentives to engage in anti-competitive behavior, particularly if you're talking about a company like Comcast that has both a broadband side of the house and a video side of the house, right?
Mm-hmm.
There are some business incentives to, for example, slow down or degrade Netflix in order to make sure that when a consumer sits down to watch TV, they choose Comcast programming and not Netflix programming. Sure, those incentives exist. Those incentives also, I think, are adequately covered by antitrust law, right? So the Federal Trade Commission, the Department of Justice have authority to prevent anti-competitive conduct like that, just like they do elsewhere in the American economy. So I guess my question then becomes, what additional protection do you get from a net neutrality rule, and how does that compare to the additional costs of adopting the Title II regime?
And I think let's just clarify that a little bit. I thought that was a very interesting point you made in your articles, that by the 2015 rule actually took away the antitrust regulatory authority of the government, but putting them back in Title II, which is where they had been prior to 2015, actually reinstates that. And anti-competitive, antitrust law basically prohibits those sort of anti-competitive practices that you were describing at the outset of our conversation. So that seems to address that issue, doesn't it, about prioritizing content and discriminating against your competitors?
Yeah, my sense is that it does. I think the primary concern that I would raise is the notion that prioritization can be good or it can be bad, right? There are anti-competitive reasons why you would engage in prioritization. There are also good consumer positive reasons why you would engage in prioritization. And the reason for that is that not all internet traffic is the same, right? We have different internet apps and services have different susceptibility to congestion. So, for example, if you have say you have four different packet streams that are coming to a congested part of a network at the same time. One of them is an email, one of them is a web page, one of them is part of a Netflix stream, and one of them is a telemedicine app, right? So a mm-hmm. surgeon in New York is guiding a surgeon in Missouri through a procedure in real time. So the network is congested so that they can't all four get through at the same time. So which gets to go through first? A net neutral rule would suggest that you can't distinguish among these various packets. You could apply like a first in, first out rule or something like that. But an engineer would tell you that's probably not the best way to manage traffic, because a few milliseconds delay in the transmission of the email or the web page would probably be imperceptible to the consumer. Whereas if you get a little bit of a delay in the Netflix video stream, right, you get that like that skip thing that happens, right?
Mm-hmm.
And the delay in the telemedicine app could be even worse, right? So
yeah, don't cut there.
Right, exactly.
Yeah, I can see that.
So there are reasons why you would want it. There are good reasons why you would want to prioritize some traffic over others. The basic and so assuming that's the case, right? Then how can you distinguish apps that need prioritization over those that don't? You could have the government decide and create a laundry list of 10,000 different applications and try to rank order them in order prioritization. You could have Comcast doing that, or you can rely upon the market mechanism to do that, right? You can use price to signal which apps need priority delivery and which don't. in the same way that we allocate scarce resources through the rest of a capitalist economy by using price to signal need.
Yeah, well, that brings us actually to the second major concern, and that is that we're going to be essentially we're not going to be having this wild, open democracy of the internet anymore. We're going to have the rich guys with the really high-speed broadband and all the rest of us poking along like we're on dial-up again.
Well, so let's distinguish what net neutrality is about and what it isn't, right? Net neutrality isn't about and has never really been about the relationship between broadband providers and consumers. Broadband providers are still allowed to offer, for example, different speeds of service to us. You and I could buy, or I should say, several ISPs offer 25 megabits, 50 megabits, 100 megabits, 1 gigabit, whatever. These are different options that are available to consumers, and net neutrality says nothing about that. What net neutrality is really focused on is the other side of the market, whether broadband providers can charge internet content companies, the Googles and the Facebooks of the world, for priority delivery over their network to consumers.
Oh, I see. So they're more concerned about the business-to-business operations. And now that you mention it, yeah, I was just in a hotel last night, and I had an option for basic internet for free and enhanced internet for a fee.
Yeah, and net neutrality doesn't say anything about that. Companies are allowed to engage in speed tiering. They're allowed to engage in what we call usage-based pricing, right? You buy a certain amount of gigabits per month, and if you exceed that, you go over. All of those business models are perfectly okay under both the 2015 rules and now.
Okay. Well, that brings us finally to the issue that's probably of most concern to listeners to this show. And realizing, of course, that these broadband service providers are private companies, and so the First Amendment doesn't necessarily apply directly. Nonetheless, there is a free speech question. I mean, these people are, in some respects, the gatekeepers of, as you say, the information highway of the 21st century. So are we concerned that they're going to start discriminating on the basis of perhaps political content or other content that an ISP might say, I don't like this particular website, so I'm going to either block it or throttle it? Are we going to encounter that?
That has been a concern over the course of the debate. And you're right, this isn't a constitutional dimension with regard to private providers. It may become a First Amendment issue with regard to municipal broadband, right?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
So broadband providers that are owned by the government may be bound by the First Amendment to engage in net neutral principles even after the repeal of the 2015 rules. Mm-hmm. But setting those aside and focusing on, you know, the Comcasts and Verizons of the world that have most of the business. When Tim Wu, who's a law professor who coined the term net neutrality, when he had first started writing, his primary concern was exactly this, that internet service providers sit at they control the highway between consumers and the information on the internet, and that gives them some control over which content gets delivered and which doesn't. And so in the early days of net neutrality literature, there was a concern that, for example, Comcast would block www.comcastsucks.com or something like that, right? Websites
yeah.
that are critical of them.
Right.
That never happened. And in fact, the primary clarion call in the last round of net neutrality debate was a lengthy cable segment by John Oliver that ended up, you know, getting delivered to consumers via HBO over cable lines, even though it was something that cable companies generally were not a big fans of.
Mm-hmm.
So to the extent that we're worried about ISPs blocking content, the record, I think, suggests that that's not really something that most companies have been involved, or at least that consumers are aware that they're doing, right? The interesting thing about speech online that's come out in the last year or so, however, has been a recognition that ISPs aren't necessarily the only gatekeeper online. So the primary instance I can think of in the last year of speech online being blocked because of the content of the speech itself was after the Charlottesville rally when a neo-Nazi website called The Daily Stormer was suddenly kicked offline.
Yeah.
And it was kicked offline because companies didn't like what they had to say. But it was, and so it was clear censorship, but it was censorship not by internet service providers. It was censorship by other companies on the internet, right? So Cloudflare lifted the type of protection that it usually offered that protect companies against direct denial of service attacks. then GoDaddy refused to register the domain name the company was on, and then Google stopped giving it space on its server to host its message. So Daily Stormer was knocked offline. It was knocked offline because of the content of its message, but it wasn't an ISP that did it. It was other companies. So what that revealed to me is that there's actually a number of potential choke points in the internet ecosystem by which speech might be stopped or rearranged. And so if the concern is that, net neutrality is not really much of a band-aid because it's only getting at one potential part of the problem and not the part that we've actually seen in practice rerouting or blocking on the basis of speech.
Yeah, let's talk about that just a little bit because I don't particularly like neo-Nazi websites. I can't say that I'm sorry for the people who were running the Stormer, but if that had been the government doing that, that would have been a clear case of First Amendment violation, censoring speech because of its content, because of its viewpoint. And yet you've got these powerful entities out there that are doing what we don't let the government do. Are you at all concerned about that generally?
Well, I think that's exactly right. But at the same time, right, Judge Easterbrook in Chicago once gave a speech where he said, internet is just the law of the horse all over again. And what he meant by that is there's nothing special about the internet anymore. There's nothing special about horses. That it all the only thing that matters for legal purposes is that there's stuff that we do, some of which takes place online. There's stuff that we do, some of which involves horses. That doesn't mean you need a special law of the horse. What I mean by that is there's an awful lot of companies, even companies that are engaged in the distribution of speech, right, that block messages on the basis of content all the time. So I'm not guaranteed, for example, to be published in the Boston Globe simply because I write a letter to the editor. They have the ability to read the letter and to decide whether to publish it or not. And nobody thinks of that as a free speech violation. In fact, in order to mandate that the Globe publish content that it disagrees with may actually violate the Globe's own free speech rights, right? Its right of editorial control.
Right. They've got editorial control. And so, yeah, I've been thinking about that myself. We've for many, many years, and probably for most of our history, newspapers have been pretty partisan. And, you know, that the solution to that is that you have other papers.
Or other radio or television, right? Other sources of content. And I think it's not much different in the context of the internet ecosystem, right? We have more than one source to get our information, and even with regard to how that information is delivered to us. The vast majority of us only have one, maybe two choices for a wireline ISP, but there are at least four national wireless carriers and several other regional carriers that blanket most of the country, and if all we're concerned about is dissemination of information, either text information or otherwise, there's a lot of options available to consumers. And so there's a sense in which the market still protects even against discrimination in that space, although it's not as perfect as we see in, for example, you know, newspapers during the golden era when there were five or six papers in every town in the U.S.
Well, Daniel, you make it sound much less of a concern than other people make it sound. So you're reassuring me here a little bit, but I suspect that this debate is not going to go away because I think the people on the other side are pretty determined to reverse the reversal of net neutrality. In fact, I hearken back to my old classmate, Gigi Sohn. She is a pretty tough cookie, so I don't think you've heard the last of her.
No, I think that's right. I think this is a fight that is going to continue. And I think, as we mentioned earlier in our conversation, I think it's a fight that's ultimately really only going to be resolved by a clear congressional statute. I think we're starting to see some coalescing of various interest groups on the boundaries of what a compromise statute might be. Most internet service providers have signaled they're okay with a no-blocking rule and a no-throttling rule. I think where the rubber hits the road is this question of how you regulate prioritization. Because as I said, there's good forms of prioritization and bad forms of prioritization. I think if you adopt a statute that treats the FCC as sort of a sector-specific antitrust authority that would allow it to review specific instances of prioritization but not block the practice outright, you'd probably get to a point where you can alleviate most of the concerns of net neutrality advocates while still allowing some of the innovation that broadband providers are worried might be squelched if you have the type of rules that were in place in 2015.
So in other words, all we need to do is reach a broad congressional bipartisan consensus. I mean, no problem, right?
I think exactly right. I think bipartisanism is really key here, because if you wind up adopting something along party lines, either a straight Republican bill or a straight Democratic bill, it's simply shifting the fight from one forum to another. Bipartisanship, I think, is the essential component that's going to create a lasting peace. How you get from here to there, I'm not entirely sure. But I will say there are plenty of smart people on the Hill on both sides that have been working for a couple of years now trying to figure out what the next version of the Communications Act would look like. In 2014, there was a initiative called the COM Act Update, where the chairman of the relevant Senate committee had sent out a series of white papers soliciting information, trying to figure out what the next version of the act should look like, how the FCC should regulate the internet, and what the rules of the road should be. It's like the 96 Act, it's going to take several years, I think, to broker the right compromise. But the wheels are definitely in motion, and that gives me a little bit of hope.
Daniel, I think the key here is to come up with a good name for the statute, not one of these really complicated statute names that you guys toss around. I think we should call it the Make the Internet Great Again Statute.
There you go.
All right. Well, Daniel A. Lyons, the Associate Professor of Law at the Boston College Law School and a fellow at the American Enterprise Institute. Thank you so very much for speaking with us today.
My pleasure. Thanks for your time.
It's your Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and we've just finished a really interesting conversation with Daniel Lyons, a law professor at Boston College, who's not too worried about the abandonment of something called net neutrality. And hey, Wayne and I are looking at the clock, and we realize we've got time for something we haven't done in a while, a Madison Minute, this time courtesy of a new kid on the block at Montpelier. His name is Matt Derrick.
Throughout his career, James Madison found himself involved in various diplomatic affairs of international scope, including the Louisiana Purchase, the War of 1812, and the Embargo Act of 1807, just to name a few. However, despite his seemingly cosmopolitan background, Madison was a homebody through and through. In fact, he is the only Secretary of State to never leave the country. Only twice left Montpelier during retirement. He pursued his education at the College of New Jersey, now Princeton University, when it was fashionable to study abroad in Europe. Dolly asked time and again if the two of them could visit France, but Madison wanted nothing to do with it. In the end, the closest they ever got to France was Richmond, or what some might have called the Paris of southeastern Virginia. I'm Matt Dara, speaking to you from the Potter Studios at Montpelier with the Madison Minute.
And that's our show. Thanks to both of our guests today, both of whom have presented some really interesting ideas about net neutrality, Roy Gutterman of Syracuse University, and of course, Daniel Lyons of Boston College. Our executive producer is Wayne Winkler. Our scheduler is Carol Hutchinson. Our distribution engineer is Chad Barrett. Our Madison Minute is by Matt Derrick. Our music is by Hannibal's Elephants. Check him out on SoundCloud. My name is Stuart Harris, and remember, you are a part of the American experiment.